Paper 10, Section 3, Old Single Column, page 110. So remember last time I was pointing out that the universal sensor that's behind this paper is doing its utmost to take what, you know, has been presented about this, as the title of this section indicates, the three persons of deity, you know, the three infinite persons, to take what they've given us about the nature and attributes of those three persons of deity and try to leverage off of that, you know, rather gently, to get us to begin to reflect on the Trinity beyond just the simple notion that, okay, well, the Trinity is a super additive consequence of the relationship of the three. Okay, next subject. But to really appreciate more, you know, the fuller nature of the Paradise Trinity, which, just like everything that we've come to recognize in the book, if you want a fuller understanding, you need to see it both from the bottom up and the top down. And in the case of the Trinity, like I pointed out, this is where it finally becomes very, very definitive. There's just so little that can be understood from the individuality viewpoint, from the bottom up point of view. Most of an understanding of the Trinity comes from beginning to see the bigger picture from the top down. So you'll see tonight, he'll bring in a couple of clever techniques of trying to leverage us into the top down point of view off of the seven absolutes of infinity. So let's jump in here.
The three persons of deity. Notwithstanding there is only one deity, there are three positive and divine personalizations of deity. Regarding the endowment of man with the divine adjusters, the Father said, "Let us make mortal man in our own image." Repeatedly throughout the Urantian writings, there occurs this reference to the acts and doings of plural deity, clearly showing recognition of the existence and working of the three sources and centers.
Okay, and let's just pause there for a second. And just, so notice what he's doing. First of all, he's dropping all the way back. Saying, okay, remember that passage in the first chapter of Genesis that we've pointed out a couple times already? That basically says, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. And, that stressing that it's not just, oh, I have this image of what man should look like, you know, but the fact that it's the likeness of God, you know, that's why the own is in there, in our own image, to combine those two expressions in the Bible together into one sentence. And then adding the mortal. Just to get you really discombobulated, I mean, to start with, it's like, wow, that's really confusing. And I certainly don't think of God as mortal. And I know the Bible, I know that's not in there. So they add, what are they getting at here? Okay. Just in the way they've quoted that line from Genesis is a challenge to try to see both viewpoints. How can it be true that from a bottom-up point of view, you're mortal, but from a top-down point of view, you're in our own image?
Yeah? So do Bible scholars or people who read the Bible ever wonder about the words us and our?
Yeah, and I talked about that a little bit when we touched on this phrase before. I mean, the rationalization scheme that's tied to that is that God is talking to his council of angels in front of him. You know, they're having a confab. And you know, that's a pretty weak rationalization scheme if you just think about it for a second, because it says make, let us make, you know, and so you have to really think that he's talking very fuzzy to rationalize it like that. I mean, the Bible even has direct statements about angels not being makers, creators. It's not his main point to stress that issue, but he obviously is bringing it up again and saying, you know, note that it does have plural there. But the whole point here is not so much to challenge our simplistic, you know, notions about the Bible, but to definitively say, you know, even from a purely evolutionary standpoint, you should have your hands firmly on the three persons of deity, like the title of the section is. Okay, so that's a given. We've got the three persons of deity. Now what? What can we do with that? Even if you're a pretty evolutionary religionist, you should have that starting point. Now what?
We are taught that the Son and the Spirit sustain the same and equal relations to the Father in the Trinity association. In eternity and as deities, they undoubtedly do, but in time and as personalities, they certainly disclose relationships of a very diverse nature. Looking from paradise out on the universes, these relationships do seem to be very similar, but when viewed from the domains of space, they appear to be quite different.
Okay. Now, notice, okay, so he's got just these few sentences we've read so far since the beginning of this section. And what is he doing? He's trying to get you to recognize that there's many viewpoints. Saying, you know, how did he start out? Okay, notwithstanding that there is only one deity. Okay, from the unity point of view, from the deity viewpoint, deity is one. But from the individuality viewpoint, which is where, you know, when you talk about personalizations of deity, when you talk about those three individual persons, you know, that's the individuality viewpoint, the universal Father, the eternal Son, the conjoint actor, or the infinite Spirit. Those are individuality viewpoint designations, three individual, separate, you know, distinct persons, but one deity, and, you know, from the unity viewpoint, there's just one God, you know, like we've talked about so many times, one God, many facets. Okay, so you have the unity viewpoint, the individuality viewpoint. You also have the eternity viewpoint and the time viewpoint. You have the paradise viewpoint and the viewpoint from within space. He's trying to get you, the very first thing he's trying to do, most definitively, is to recognize that you can't understand everything from just one point of view. There are other viewpoints, and it's not an alternate reality. It's the same reality, but it looks very different depending on how you look at it. And as initially discombobulating as that might be, the first word of the section was, notwithstanding. You can't let your initial simplistic understanding be absolutized. You have to allow it to be challenged. You have to take the word notwithstanding as revelatory, and that it is valid to look at it both ways. It's not that just it appears that there's unity from the top down, or there appears to be individuals from the bottom up. There literally are individuals, and there literally is one. It's not just one is not an illusion, and one is not a mirage or something. They're both literally facts at the same time. The universe is a more complicated thing than our simple little initial consciousness suspects. And so just allow that to be, even if you can't, you know, in some very direct way Oh, yeah, that's completely understandable. Just know that it is. Allow it to be. Know that you can switch viewpoints. And what you're doing is not creating an alternative reality. You're trying to understand more of what this thing is that, really is this, in many ways, the super additive consequence of those two viewpoints. And you might say it's neither in that sense. But it's a way, but by taking two different viewpoints and multiple, dual viewpoints, you can begin to get a better sense of what it is, as independent of your initial limitations. Okay, yeah.
There are things that one excludes the other. But are you saying in this case it's an a priori?
What I'm saying is this is a possibility. This is not saying that there's square circles. It is a fact that there aren't square circles. Just the very fact that you can tell, even without limited understanding, that this is a distinct possibility, even if it isn't an immediate understanding, is that you can begin to draw analogies that help you to understand this, like we've done. Like the island seafloor analogy. When all you see is above the surface of water, it looks like there's these separate islands that, they're not connected by anything. But you follow them down to the seafloor, and it's all one blob of matter. It's one and separate. The very fact that you can make a simple analogy like that and begin, one doesn't exclude the other. That's a clue. If there's analogies, but you can't make an analogy of how a circle is a square. There is no such analogy. That's fundamentally illogical. So it's one thing for it not to be immediately understandable. It's another thing for it to be illogical. And when you begin to just notice that, I have an ability in the absence of direct rational understanding to distinguish logical from illogical. How's that possible? So you've been given that ability to have a reality response to a presentation like this where it says notwithstanding, and you can still have a reality response that says, in spite of the difficulty, I know that's true. Somehow I just know that's true, that there's unity and individuality. I'm just going to go forward with that knowledge. Maybe that knowingness, maybe I should say.
Right there, it starts off with deity is like beyond that. So we've got to kind of trust in where these beings are coming from, because they're trying to relate something to us, like you were saying, that is beyond our ability to directly experience.
Let me just make one little comment on that. That's a good point. This bridge between the unity and the individuality. In many ways, you're the beginnings of an understanding of the connection lies in the fact of personality. Like they're pointing out here, personality is such a phenomenon, such a thing, if you will, that it can take unity and focus it into individuality so that you can contact it. In the island analogy, it's the thing that draws the islands up off the seafloor. Personality is this focusing fact that can make the otherwise intangible tangible. All right.
The divine sons are indeed the word of God, but the children of the Spirit are truly the act of God. God speaks through the Son and with the Son acts through the infinite Spirit. While in all universe activities, the Son and the Spirit are exquisitely fraternal, working as two equal brothers with admiration and love for an honored and divinely respected common Father.
Look at that gentle evolutional on-ramp there. Yeah. Speaking very colloquially. I like that.
The Father, Son, and Spirit are certainly equal in nature, coordinate in being, but there are unmistakable differences in their universe performances. And when acting alone, each person of deity is apparently limited in absoluteness. The Universal Father, prior to his self-willed divestment of the personality, powers, and attributes which constitute the Son and the Spirit, seems to have been philosophically considered an unqualified, absolute, and infinite deity. But such a theoretical first source and center without a Son could not in any sense of the word be considered the Universal Father. Fatherhood is not real without sonship. Furthermore, the Father, to have been absolute in a total sense, must have existed at some eternally distant moment alone. But he never had such a solitary existence. The Son and the Spirit are both co-eternal with the Father. The first source and center has always been, and will forever be, the eternal Father of the original Son, and, with the Son, the eternal progenitor of the infinite Spirit.
And just, you know, again, you know, it's fairly straightforward, you know, reminder of this basic understanding of the three persons. But that little bit in there, I just wanted to remind you how we've talked a little bit more complexly, and you know, you might say a little more precisely than this gentle on-ramp here about this philosophically considered thing. I mean, that technically, that notion that they're speaking to there is God the infinite, you know, that initial philosophic concept where there's just this unqualified, absolute, infinite deity. That's, you know, the notion of God the infinite as a concept. You know, I shouldn't say notion. That's giving it a little bit, you know, it's a definitive concept. But it's just a concept like the I am. And it's just one way of thinking about in the beginning, you know, there was something and then it had to break. You know, and here they're kind of just painting the picture. You have sort of one great big person and then it breaks into three persons. But you know, it's not so much a theoretical first source and center as it is a theoretical God the infinite.
We observe that the Father has divested himself of all direct manifestations of absoluteness except absolute fatherhood and absolute volition. We do not know whether volition is an inalienable attribute of the Father. We can only observe that he did not divest himself of volition. Such infinity of will must have been eternally inherent in the first source and center.
And so, I mean, that part, so absolute fatherhood, absolute volition, those are the two things. And that absolute, you know, and they're talking a little bit about the absolute volition, that the volitional absolute that you see so definitively manifest as the so-called personality circuit of the Universal Father. That, you know, what they're saying is you don't necessarily, you know, if you just call it self-personalized deity, and before you name it the Universal Father, it's like, well, that has to be part of the Father. But if you just think about it conceptually, that self-personalized deity, I mean, you know, like they're saying, I mean, it doesn't immediately demand that stay connected to the other facets of the Father. But, you know, they know it is, and that's why they call that the Universal Father. Now, that's really that personality face, you know, that anchor point for the volitional circuit. Yep.
I looked up the word concept and the word notion, and basically it's saying this is the same word.
Right, but they aren't, and that's what I was trying to point out. You shouldn't use them as the same word. Notion is purposely, it's arbitrary and slightly derogatory. I mean, it's indicating, you know, a bit of juvenile thought, you know, to just have a notion, okay? You know, and it also is ripe with the desire to absolutize your notion. You know, your thought is the thought. Idea and concept are more definitive terms than notion. Concept is the bigger term. Concept is a term that means generalized idea, basically. Yeah. So if you have more than just some, you know, little idea nugget, you know, you've got like the I am, okay? You don't call the I am an idea, you call the I am a concept. So we've stressed that a lot, and he's reminding us of that again. You know, he's not the personality absolute, he's only the volitional absolute. He's not the absolute spirit, he's not the absolute mind, or any other absolute thing you can think of. There's just two elements of absoluteness that he didn't divest himself of.
In bestowing absoluteness of personality upon the eternal Son, the universal Father escapes from the fetters of personality absolutism, but in so doing, he takes a step which makes it forever impossible for him to act alone as the personality absolute. And with the final personalization of coexistent deity, the conjoined actor, there ensues the critical Trinitarian interdependence of the three divine personalities with regard to the totality of deity function in absolute.
Okay, that last little bit. Let's bring in a little bit more precise words. Okay, the totality of deity function in absolute. Deity function in absolute, there's a word for that. Absoluteness with a capital A. Another way of saying it would be deity function on the absolute level. Deity functioning on the absolute level is called absoluteness, with capital A. And the divinity of that functioning of deity is absoluteness with a lowercase a, which they've been using, you know, as you've noticed, leading up to this. Okay? So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about absoluteness, capital A. How much of that functioning of deity on the absolute level is in his hands. How much has been divested to others? Okay. I just wanted to, you know, that big, you know, mouthful of an expression can all be, so it's the totality of absoluteness. You know, he does not possess the totality of absoluteness, just a portion of absoluteness, capital A.
God is the Father absolute of all personalities in the universe of universes. The Father is personally absolute in liberty of action, but in the universes of time and space, made in the making and yet to be made, the Father is not discernibly absolute as total deity except in the Paradise Trinity.
Okay. Now, it's not a coincidence that when you are reading the Paradise Trinity paper, that more than half of the times in the entire book, when they use the expression total deity, lowercase t, you know, we always are batting about total deity, more than half of the references are in this paper. Because like I said, you can't really begin to understand much of anything about the Paradise Trinity until you start to think about total deity. The majority of what can be understood about the Paradise Trinity, comes from that top-down viewpoint and the perspective of total deity that's in that viewpoint. know, when I brought up that absoluteness, capital A, the functioning of deity on the absolute level. Okay, so when they're saying here, you know, absolute is total deity except in the paradise trinity. Okay. In other words, he doesn't function at all the functional levels of total deity, but the paradise trinity does. As the trinity of absoluteness, capital T, capital A, the trinity of absoluteness, the functioning of the trinity on the absolute level, that functioning is on every level of total deity, all seven levels. Flip back to the beginning of the foreword, you know, to section one, you know, there on page two, and remember the, you know, those seven functional levels of total deity. The Father is on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, but not on 7. Self-contained deity, you know, that's part of the, you know, part of that is the first center. Self-willed deity, the infinite one, the first source. Self-personalized deity, that's the universal Father. Self-distributive deity, that's the universal creator. Self-expansive deity, that's the universal controller. Self-experiential deity, that's the infinite upholder. Okay. But on seven there, he's not self-projected deity. That's the infinite capacity. And he's not time-space transcending deity. That's the ultimate. Okay. He's not directly functioning on all seven levels. That's one of the things that's, you know, sort of the subtext of what they just said there. But the Paradise Trinity is functioning on every level. So total deity, i.e. spanning all the functional levels of total deity, he doesn't do that like the Paradise Trinity does directly. That's what they're getting. That's another thing that he's let go of when he freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. But there's one facet of deity that that doesn't let go of that whole spectrum. And that's the Paradise Trinity. Yeah. Okay, so now look at this interesting little list that they threw in here.
The first source and center functions outside of Havona in the phenomenal universes as follows. One, as a creator, through the creator's sons, his grandsons. Two, as controller, through the gravity center of paradise. Three, as spirit, through the eternal sun. Four, as mind, through the conjoint creator. Five, as a father, he maintains parental contact with all creatures through his personality circuit. Six, as a person, he acts directly throughout creation by his exclusive fragments, and mortal man by the thought adjusters. Seven, as total deity, he functions only in the Paradise Trinity.
Okay. So so just notice how they're touching on the different facets of the Father as creator. Okay, in other words, you know, literally the universal creator, that facet, the universal creator. Just, you know, a little bit of an extended comment here since they threw in this. Through the creator's sons, his grandsons. Now, if you're just thinking about sons, a direct father-son lineage, not parents, but just father and sons, like we're all ascending sons, whether we're male or female, that, in that context, you have the universal father. Drop down one notch, you have the son, the eternal son, and then you have the grandsons, the creator sons. So the creator sons are grandsons in just that son hierarchy. Okay, but if we do it in parental mode, you know, which if you want to be really, you know, again, more explicit about this, like we've talked about, the Creator sons don't just have one parent. You know, they aren't just the offspring of the Eternal Son. They have two parents. You know, most precisely, those parents are the Father as the universal Creator and the Son as the coordinate Creator. There's a mother and a father, and a Creator Son is a child then. Instead of saying son, I mean, you know, when you have the two parents, you'd say that's a child. And in that lineage, we're the grandchildren. You know, and there's a spot in the book where they refer to us as the grandchildren. It's in that sense, see, that we're, okay. In this sense, we would be the great-grandsons. Okay. There's another simple example. See, I mean, the language is very precise, and it depends on, you know, you're not indicating the same thing when you say grandson and grandchild. That's how precise the book is using language. you know, if you want to, you know, bring in the rest of the story, you know, that of you being a grandchild, you know, what's the other side of the family? That's just one side of the family. You also have the infinite spirit and the paradise trinity as the parents of a creative mother spirit. You know, and then you're the child, you know, so you're the grandchild in that sequence too. You know, you have two lineages. Okay, so that's just a fun little aside they throw in there. And then, of course, you know, the universal controller is literally, you know, we're talking about as controller. That's the universal controller, which is, you know, immediately engaging the Isle of Paradise. Yeah, and then that engages the universe. As spirit, when you're talking about the Eternal Son, as spirit, remember we're talking about divesting absolute functioning. What do you call the Eternal Son in that mode? The absolute spirit, right? I mean, the Father is not the absolute spirit. The Eternal Son is, okay? The conjoined actor, the conjoined creator, is the absolute mind. Father's not the absolute mind. Yeah. Okay. You know, the only two things he has absolute fatherhood and absolute volition. He's the Father absolute, and he's the volitional absolute, and that's it. He's not the absolute mind. He's not the absolute spirit. He's not the personality absolute, etc. Okay. And then of course, as a father with the personality circuit, that's that facet of the Father called the universal Father. Has that self-personalized deity, that circuit. And then we all know that the thought adjusters are a fragment of the infinite upholder aspect of the Father. You know, so you can see, you know, they're bringing in all those different aspects. And then, you know, like I said, he doesn't function through all the levels, total deity. And that's only the Paradise Trinity that does that.
It's a little mystifying as a person. You know, the pastors are free persons.
Right. But I've tried to point that out. I mean, even though the thought adjusters are not persons, the force charge of space is certainly not a person, those two together are his personal ministry. In the same way that the Holy Spirit is not a person. But it is a personal spiritual ministry of the Creative Mother Spirit. The Spirit of Truth is not a person, but it is a personal spiritual ministry, you know, of the Master Son. The thought adjusters are a personal spiritual ministry, when you think of them as pure spirit, of the Father Absolute.
It seems to me, in my logic, that absolute fatherhood is in the way, see, he's a father of the Eternal Son. And that fatherhood is kind of like you were talking about earlier. It's not a direct fatherhood.
Yeah, but you're thinking too immediate.
But the volition.
He's the initiator of everything.
Right.
He's the father of everything. Yeah. He's the initiator.
Yeah.
Okay? He initiated you, yeah, not just the eternal Son.
So that's separate, okay, from his volitional service.
Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah, it's you know, that's the root of his nature, is the initiator. Like they're saying, I mean, not only he also held on, they noticed he also held on to being the volitional absolute. You know, but that basic fact of being the Father and this overarching source of direction, he is the absolute, you know, fatherhood of the universe. He's the Father absolute.
Well, my point is, it's kind of a distant.
Yes, he is not personally present out here.
More intimate relation with the Father is really the volitional circuit.
Right, and so that's why you should take delight in cultivating,
right,
so that you're not just a being of will dignity, but you're actually a volitional being. You're actually exercising that will.
Yeah, then
you're actually, you know, striking step with that volitional absolute, with that circuit. You're exercising your nature as a personal self. That's how he feels your presence.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This other way.
As a volitional phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Not just as a point personality fact, you know, static, you know, some, you know, personality fact, but as this dynamic volitional phenomenon.
He was my initiator, but look how far away
he is. Yeah.
People have been saying that for centuries.
You can be volitional because he's provided a pathway through which volition can flow. It's his circuit.
And that's
if he didn't have that circuit, you could try to be volitional and nothing would happen. There would be no place for it to flow, no wire for that current to flow through. Okay? You could try to be spiritual, but if there wasn't the Son's spirit circuit, you couldn't do it. There would be no way for that energy to flow. It would have no pathway. Okay, he said a lot of things, but when all is said and done, the two bottom lines of the previous paragraph and then this paragraph of the list is Paradise Trinity, total deity. Okay, you want to start to understand either one, you need to understand both. That's the core, like we've been saying. Trinity is this fundamental top-down phenomenon in most senses.
All these relinquishments and delegations of jurisdiction by the Universal Father are wholly voluntary and self-imposed. The all-powerful Father purposefully assumes these limitations of universe authority. The Eternal Son seems to function as one with the Father in all spiritual respects, except in the bestowals of the God fragments and in other pre-personal activities. Neither is the Son closely identified with the intellectual activities of material creatures, nor with the energy activities of the material universes. As absolute, the Son functions as a person and only in the domain of the spiritual universe.
The absolute spirit.
The infinite spirit is amazingly universal and unbelievably versatile in all his operations. He performs in spheres of mind, matter, and spirit. The conjoint actor represents the Father-Son association, but he also functions as himself. He is not directly concerned with physical gravity, with spiritual gravity, or with the personality circuit, but he more or less participates in all other universe activities. While apparently dependent on three existential and absolute gravity controls, the infinite spirit appears to exercise three super controls. This threefold endowment is employed in many ways to transcend and seemingly to neutralize even the manifestations of primary forces and energies, right up to the super ultimate borders of absoluteness. In certain situations, these super controls absolutely transcend even the primal manifestations of cosmic reality.
We talked about that. That's some. Before I get into that, it just okay. So notice how he's finished up this section. He's very much like I think I mentioned last week. You know, he's about initially here in this paper, trying to really get us to think definitively about what is in the hands of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, so that you could begin to reflect on what other things need to be in someone's hands. And you notice that they're not in the Father's hands, they're not in the Son's hands, they're not in the Spirit's hands. And you've got a first little thing that you kind of should have picked up. Oh yeah, he keeps referring to something that appears to not be in any of those three hands. This whole thing, he's bringing up total deity, and I'm not quite sure I understand what he's talking about, but he keeps saying that that's just, you know, the Trinity that's got that whole total deity thing covered. And the other three of them don't have the whole thing covered. Okay. Now, this is a significant additional comment about transcending the absolutes. Like we were talking about when we were in the previous papers, when we were talking about the third source and center. And notice here, they're reminding you, it's not just anti-gravity in the physical sense, where the third source and center and some of the offspring of the third source and center have the ability to neutralize, isn't that the word that they just, you use that word, neutralize some of the centering influence of the absolute gravity of the aisle. It's not just that circuit. See, there's three circuits. And so, when he says, he is not directly concerned with physical gravity, with spiritual gravity, or with the personality circuit, personality gravity. That anti-gravity thing, that physical gravity, we've talked a bunch about that. Oh, and I hadn't really thought about the spiritual gravity, but okay, so you have the two substances, you have matter and spirit, and he's just saying that the third source and center has the ability not only to go all the way up to the ultimate borders of absoluteness, but to go beyond and actually override to some degree both of those physical and spiritual gravities. Okay, and that shouldn't be too radical, but the third thing? Did that sink in as we passed that? Okay. What about the personality circuit of the Universal Father? He says there's beings that come from the third source and center can have the ability to transcend the absoluteness of the Father's connection to you in his circuit. Wait a minute. We've talked about that. This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. Okay, now what does that mean? As an individual, I have this absolute individual relationship to the Father, which, if that's all there was, would mean that I would have a universe all by myself, with the face of the Father looking at me, and Jim would have another universe all by himself, absolutely separate, because he has an absolutely, separate individual relationship. But that's not the universe we experience. We experience a fact in the universe that overrides that absolute separation, something that supersedes, that transcends that absolute personality link. Yeah, we know what that is. That's the mother. The third source and center, like a creative mother spirit, can have a collective personal linkage to all of us, transcending the absolute individuation that the Father established. Just like one of those mechanical controllers can transcend the Isle of Paradise absolute gravity a little bit. That's a very important key, you know, just to pause on that. And it's like, well, wait a minute, what does that mean? That's what that's about. If the third source and center didn't have that ability to be, you know, to be something that could be above the absolute personality circuit, there would be no connectivity as persons between us. Okay. You want to read?
We're at number four now.
Yep. So here's what Jim was alluding to. This is what he's going to take care of this issue, and he's going to do it in a very fun little way that is really challenging you to not think simplistically. Notice what he does here.
Four. The Trinity union of deity. Of all absolute associations, the Paradise Trinity, the first triunity, is unique as an exclusive association of personal deity. God functions as God only in relation to God and to those who can know God, but as absolute deity only in the Paradise Trinity and in relation to the universe totality.
Okay, now that's a pretty impenetrable little paragraph to start with, especially the way it starts out, because if you have any familiarity with the book, you know, if you aren't just starting reading from the beginning and, you know, and you get to this, you know, and you wouldn't really notice anything. But if you're familiar with the book, you're going, what do they mean? The first triunity, the triunities are really complicated, but I know enough that I know that the first triunity is something different than the Paradise Trinity. It looks like they're saying they're the same thing here. Okay. Remember what I pointed out. This is many, many times in the book, you have a literal parenthetical, for instance, like this. You've got to figure out what kind of a parenthetical it is. Is it the kind of parenthetical that means these two are equal? Or is it the kind of parenthetical that's saying, well, technically, it's not this, it's this? But, you know, you're immature at this point, and I don't want to confuse you too much, but, you know, you're not going to be immature forever. At some point, you're going to be reading this book for the second time, and you will have read, you know, paper 104, and, you know, you'll know something's afoot. Like, if we just flip up there to paper 104, 104, section 3, paragraph 8, it says point blank, the Paradise Trinity is not a triunity. Okay? So, either you've just found a mistake in the book, or you're thinking too simplistically. Okay? What's the difference? What's the fundamental difference between the Paradise Trinity and the First Triunity? The First Triunity is something that's an immediate consequence in the individuality viewpoint. In the individuality viewpoint, you have these three absolute persons. Okay? And the three absolute persons can work together in an association. They don't, you know, fuse together into one person. They're just working together in a functional association. The triunities are functional associations. There's a functional association of the three absolute individuals. Persons are in. There's three persons in the first triunity. Okay. Even from the individuality viewpoint, if you want to be precise about it, it's not the three persons who have a superadditive consequence that's the Paradise Trinity. It's the three facets of deity, the Father, the Son, the Spirit, that have a superadditive consequence. That's the Paradise Trinity. And it's not a functional association. It's a literal organic superadditive consequence, a fourth fact. Okay? Here, see, of all absolute associations, you know, something or other is unique as an exclusive association of personal deity. Okay. If you want to, okay, See, technically, we're not talking about the Paradise Trinity there. That's why the parenthetical's there, for the more advanced reader to know that, okay, well, you know, but he's trying not to make it too complicated here. He's not trying to bring in the triunities for the initial reader here. But he has to put it in there because it's, you know, it's not technically correct that association of three persons functioning together is the Paradise Trinity, but it's an initial gentle on-ramp. Because it's like you were saying, Jimmy, I mean, that's the historical notion of the Paradise Trinity, is three persons functioning together. But that's, you know, technically that's the first triunity.
Trinity is more related to deity.
Right. And like I was saying, I mean, really the superadditive consequence is between the three facets of deity giving you the Paradise Trinity, not the three persons. It's like, well, wait a minute, facets of deity, that's really a unity viewpoint, see, that's the whole thing. You really don't have a proper way to think about it unless you look at it from the top down. You have to get the deity viewpoint. And in the deity viewpoint, you don't have that three facets of deity, super additive consequence. That's a bit of a individuality viewpoint kludge. It's a way of kludging the Paradise Trinity into the picture where you have just the seven absolutes of infinity as a starting point.
To really understand the Trinity, you got to start looking at it from the top.
Won't understand it. You just won't. And a number of the statements in the book will be really illogical if you think about them carefully. See? Okay? That's the whole point. That's why I think it's six times in this paper he says total deity. Okay?
The father loves the individual, but the mother can, through the infinite spirit, can transcend that.
If the mother, you know, if you want to speak in terms of love, the mother loves us collectively.
Now, do you think people can have insights into that collective mother phenomenon without recognizing the father? Have you ever thought of that?
I mean, like everything, the father is the initiator of everything.
So
I mean,
the father has to...
You're familiar enough with, you know, my total deity paper to know that the first thing that comes out as you begin to unpack total deity is the complete understanding of the father, not the mother.
Yeah.
Once you have a complete understanding of the father, then, you know, down the road, finally the mother unpacks out of the picture. And, you know, you begin to see how she fits into the picture. If you have an incomplete picture of the Father, if you haven't fully initiated your relationship with total deity,
yeah.
You can't get to the Mother. And that's kind of what I'm pointing out. It's kind of what he's trying to do here in a simple evolutional way. He's trying to say, okay, all the things you know about, let's get them all really clearly defined and set over here. And you notice there's something else that's not in either of those three bins. Okay?
Well, I was just wondering. I'll just throw it out there. Okay. Discuss it. But, you know, the burgeoning of holistic thinking that kind of, you know, epitomized in the late 60s, you know, and you gave a song that, you know, had the work lyrics like that. I sometimes wonder, these people that had these insights, that wrote these songs, are they building upon, unbeknownst to them, a habitual pattern that's been passed down to them of the father, you know?
I mean, just take a simple little thing. I mean, I don't want to belabor this, but just a simple little thing along those lines. Western medicine is a medicine of parts. They see the body as a collection of parts. They see the body as father-like. They don't know that, but assume that the body is purely a father-like fact, a collection of parts. He's the individuality of the parts. You know, he individuates the parts, makes them, you know, parts. Okay, but Eastern medicine has the notion of the whole. Okay? And how did they come upon that notion of the body as a whole? They never could quite get to the Father in their religious thinking, and they sort of, you know, fuzzily stumbled into a whole more holistic, you know, mother-like concept. You know, in some sense, it's like the supreme and some things like this. See, that's why they have that. You know, you have, they have some recognition of the whole, the mother.
Right.
So right there in medicine, you have this, you know, and it's like, well, what is it? Is it a whole or is it parts? No, it's both. It's like, well, it can't be both. Yes, it can. You can have deity and individuality.
their recognition of the whole.
You have these medicines that address a part, and then you have this long disclaimer expressing all of the negative ramifications
right.
to the whole.
Because they've taken no consideration of the whole. Right. And trying to think that you can just engage a part. No, if you punch a part, you move the whole. Because those parts don't exist in a vacuum like current Western physical thought assumes. Yeah. And again, let's not go on to that. But you know, a whole lot of things are father-like theories, and that's their problem. It's fundamentally not a father, you know, dominantly a father-like fact. It's more of a mother-like fact. You need a mother-like theory.
Well, let me just say one last thing, but those mother-like things, especially coming from the East, they were arrested in their vertical development.
There's a lot of mysticism in it and whatnot, right? That's why I'm working so hard to get everyone to see, you know, that this is a fundamental part of the revelation, to make the notion of the whole and the individuality of the whole not some vague, fuzzy Eastern mysticism, but a solid, definitive fact that's just as solid as the Father. Yeah.
Eternal deity is perfectly unified. Nevertheless, there are three perfectly individualized persons of deity. The Paradise Trinity makes possible the simultaneous expression of all the diversity of the character traits and infinite powers of the first source and center and his eternal coordinates, and of all the divine unity of the universe functions of undivided deity.
Just one little thing. I've got off on that tangent. I forgot that there's one little important thing I need to point out in that previous paragraph at the end there. But as absolute deity, only in the Paradise Trinity, and in relation to universe totality. Okay, this is a very important point about the Paradise Trinity. There is only one facet of deity, period. Only one facet of deity that directly embraces infinity, the totality of reality. And that's the Paradise Trinity. Not even the Father directly embraces the totality of reality. Only the Paradise Trinity does. And remember the Divine Counselor told us that up towards the end of the foreword. Okay, here the Universal Censor is reminding you of that. You know, when you start to go through the list of things of who does what, you know, what facet of deity, directly embraces the totality of reality? Well, it's not the Father, it's not the Son, it's not the Spirit. Well, what is it? Okay. Only the Paradise Trinity directly embraces infinity. So he's bringing out, the Paradise Trinity makes possible the simultaneous expression of all the diversity of the character traits and infinite powers of the first source and center in his eternal coordinates and of all the divine unity of the universe functions of undivided deity. That, you know, it's like, okay, we've been talking and talking and talking about the three individuals. If you flip it around, like we say, you know, one way to just simple way to think about it is I have it all together, and you can express three individuals if someone holds on to the undivided deity that you would lose. If you just took it and just literally broke it into, you know, the loaf of bread into three chunks, you would lose undivided deity. In the simple way they're talking about it here. So there has to, you know, in order to have those three to be free to be individuals, someone has to hold on. Okay. And not only, you know, does holding on allow them to exist, but just, you know, it isn't just a passive fact. That which remains after you separate the three individuals can do things. You know, this, and all the divine unity of the universe functions of undivided deity. Okay? Not only do you free up the three individuals to function as individuals by having something hold on to that residual unity, but that residual unity now can function without being muddied by the three individuals clogging up the works. It's this pure unity of deity. You know, with no individuality potential roadblocks in it, you've pulled all that out and you have this nice pure expression. You know, that's kind of the simple way. Of, you know. So again, it's just another thing he's trying to point out. You need to have all the divine unity of the universe functions. That if you have the concept of undivided deity, you know what that could do. So he's trying to get you to see why there needs to be a paradise trinity, why you can't just have the three persons, and or even in addition to that, the first triunity, just them associating, because there's still divided deity. You know, there has to be undivided deity functioning as undivided deity.
The Trinity actually frees them up to be a triunity.
Right. And frees itself up to do what only undivided deity can do.
The Trinity is an association of infinite persons functioning in a non-personal capacity, but not in contravention of personality.
You're not in conflict with.
The illustration is crude, but a father, son, and grandson could form a corporate entity which would be non-personal, but nonetheless subject to their personal wills.
See, so again, he's still, you know, trying to give that individuality viewpoint, you know, a little bit more play. But you can tell, you know, it's getting a little tedious for him. You know, the illustration is crude. let's all try to just move on. Instead of trying to come up with some crude corporate, you know, non-personal entity analogy, you know, to understand the bottom-up point of view, you know, you can get out of that by just taking a top-down point of view. All right.
Paradise Trinity is real. It exists as the deity union of Father, Son, and Spirit. Yet the Father, the Son, or the Spirit, or any two of them, can function in relation to this self-same paradise trinity. The Father, Son, and Spirit can collaborate in a non-trinity manner, but not as three deities. As persons, they can collaborate as they choose, but that is not the Trinity.
As persons, it's the first triunity. Yeah.
Ever remember that what the infinite spirit does is the function of the conjoint actor. Both the Father and the Son are functioning in and through and as him. But it would be futile to attempt to elucidate the Trinity mystery, three as one and in one, and one as two and acting for two.
Okay, so now here is where, notice he separates this by, this paragraph by itself, by big paragraph breaks. Okay, he's really laying his cards down here now, giving you a challenge. What on earth is he talking about? The one is two and acting for two? What does that mean? Okay, but he's very clever. Look at how he's used what they've taught us so far about the first, second, and third sources and centers. He reminds us, he says, ever remember that what the infinite spirit does is the function of the conjoint actor. Okay, now what's that statement about?
Well,
And I've tried to really stress this coming out of talking about the third source and center. If you want to be very precise in talking about the third source and center, there's a personal side and an impersonal side. The name of the personal side is the conjoint actor. The name of the impersonal side is right. Every member that what that impersonal expression does is the function of a person. Okay, there's a person behind that impersonal expression that is the infinite spirit. In other words, the two are together as two expressions of one fact. It's the third source and center. Okay, but it's one fact, but it has these two faces. Ever remember that, he says. And then he tosses in, okay, both the Father and the Son are functioning in and through and as him, i.e. the conjoint actor. Like, okay, yeah, I figured that out when I read about the third source and center, that we think of the Father, you know, the eternal universal Father and the eternal Son, and they get together conjointly, have this conjoint expression that is the conjoint actor, two persons, you know, giving rise super additively to this third person, the conjoint actor, and that the two of them are functioning in and through, you know, he's the spear point of all action, the God of action, and as him. Okay, yeah, I understand that. Okay, so he says that, and then he brings in this statement about the Trinity. Okay, now the first part, three as one and in one. Okay, yeah, that's just like we were talking about. You have two as one and in one. When you're thinking about the universal Father and the eternal Son coming together conjointly as the conjoint actor, like he just reminded us of. It's like, I could think about the Paradise Trinity in that bottom-up individuality viewpoint, like we, you know, so often do. I have the three of them as one and in one, you know, not just the association, but this literal organic fact. It's like, okay, and that's a lot like the two persons, you know, in and as the conjoint actor. Okay, but what on earth? The one as two and acting for two. Well, I mean, you know, in the same way, like I said, the three as one and in one, how that's kind of like the two as one, you know, and acting for two. Okay, but that's not what he said. He didn't say the two as one. He said the one as two and acting for two.
Wouldn't one be the Trinity?
So what is this referring to? It doesn't seem to have anything to do with the relationship between the Father and the Son and the conjoint actor. Oh, he mentioned one other thing here. He said, ever remember that when you think about the third source and center, it has a personal creator side and it has a impersonal controller side. It has a conjoint actor and the infinite spirit. You know, and the person, you know, personal side is the actor. Okay? Even when you're seeing the functioning of the infinite spirit, you know, the person is still the actor. The two are together as one. Okay. Now, once you've worked through the total deity viewpoint a little bit, soon as you get to the point where you can lay out all of the facets of the Father, there it is staring at you. You've got this thing called the universal one of infinity, and it has two sides. One is the Paradise Trinity, and the other is that root of the Father, the first center. He's combining the individuality and the unity viewpoints here. If I come up through the individuality viewpoint, the three as one and in one, but it doesn't stop there. Beyond that, you know, basically, you know, you get up above and look at it from top down, there's one as two and acting for two. There's one, the Paradise Trinity, but it's as two. There's two sides of the universal one of infinity. Okay. And remember, we were just talking about the will, the actions, the purpose of the Paradise Trinity. That the dynamics of the Paradise Trinity, once you begin to understand, you know, what the universal one of infinity is, it's that fundamental causal cycle, that which acts, going to that which reacts, going to that which results, and back to that which acts, you know, okay? It's acting for two.
One of the
See? Well, no. No, the Trinity. The Trinity is as two, the two sides of the universal one of infinity, and is acting for the two. Remember, that's one thing we've been building up. There's some things that the Paradise Trinity can only do. Only the Paradise Trinity can do. Like, the things that, in order to do them, you have to be the one facet of deity that directly engages the totality of reality. When that needs to be done, it acts. It acts for the two. Now, and see, think what he's trying to do is get you to, you know, in this whole story about trying to get to the Trinity through the three persons, you know, the Father has always been kind of primary, as he always is, you know, in the discussion. You know, once you see it in the unity viewpoint, you know, who's immediately on the other side of from the Paradise Trinity? It's not the Son or the Spirit. It's not the totality of the Father either, but it is the root of the Father. It's the first center, okay? And when, and so think about the first, the Father wants to do something as total deity. Well, he can't. Okay, he can start. Well, can my infinite upholder part do it? No. Well, can, you know, he can go all the way around, you know, and none of those things, because none of them have, you know, are directly engaging infinity. He comes all the way around to the first center, you know, and through the first center and into the Paradise Trinity, it can act for him. Okay, what has he been saying? As total deity, he, the Father, functions only in the Paradise Trinity. And that's literally how, through the universal one of infinity, you go from the root of the Father into the Paradise Trinity on the other side. The Father is in the Paradise Trinity and can function in the only way that that undivided deity can function. He can't. He's divided. Paradise Trinity is undivided. Okay. Okay. So that's that very cryptic statement. See, is about the understanding the universal one of infinity and its two sides and the Father's connection to the Paradise Trinity through it and the Trinity acting for him, acting for the two, for itself and for him.
Is that personal and impersonal acting? Becoming one at that point.
I mean, when we speak of the Paradise Trinity, we just say it's the impersonal side. You know, and the first center is like, well, it's not really personal, but you could say it's omnipersonal. Okay, okay. Yeah, and see, and at this point, the whole personality thing is really kind of broken down. You're kind of fudging a bit to talk about it, you know, as personal and impersonal. But he purposely brought up that ever remember the infinite spirit conjoint actor to, you know, so that you have these clues that if you're finally trying to work in the total deity viewpoint and put this together, you've got this little statement. See, yeah. There's two sides. The universal one of infinity. Just like there's two sides to the third source and center.
And those two,
that's the parallel he's drawing upon there.
And those two sides to the universal one of infinity are what again?
the first center,
right,
and the Paradise Trinity.
Right, that's what I thought.
Yeah. The root of the Father.
So that's what the one has two,
yeah,
acting for two. The right. One is
it's
the Trinity.
Yep.
And it's acting for both the Trinity and the universal
and,
one of infinity.
And, no, no, and the Father.
And the Father.
The Father can't do it. You know, and that's literally how the Father gets, you know, can connect to the Paradise Trinity to have it do what it like done, if you want to, you know, anthropomorphize
right.
it kind of like that, see? Yeah, through the first center, the Father has access to the Trinity, but the Father is not the Trinity. See, he's trying to get at the functioning of the Trinity, the things that it does that the Father can't do. It has to do for the Father. Or if you want to flip it, like he's been doing, the Father does those things in it. You know, yeah. Now there's a lot of mystery there, but. He obviously doesn't want the one as two and acting for two to just be, you know, inscrutable, or he wouldn't have put it down on the page, okay? It's the doorway to the mystery. I mean, the Trinity is fraught with lots of mystery, okay? But to begin to understand that it's one side of the universe, one of infinity, and those sorts of issues, the Breviters have given us what we need to figure that out.
Interesting. If
the Paradise Trinity is truly one of infinity.
It's not fair how they told us it would be futile. And I accepted that.
I think it would be interesting to find out if you could.
But notice, see, the mystery is not three as one and in one. And the mystery is not the one as two and acting for two. The mystery is the two together. Like I've been saying, the mystery, you know, that's always the mystery. How you have the top down and the bottom up at the same time. I mean, why is the thought adjuster the mystery of mysteries? It's not because of its bottom up nature. It's not because of its top down nature. It's because it's both at the same time. That's the mystery. You know, somehow, you know, if you just think of it from the bottom-up point of view, it's this little fragment that's in your mind, and it does, you know, it's the mystery monitor, and okay, fine. Okay, from the top-down point of view, it's this fragment of the Father that has access to all this, you know, absolute quality and all this stuff. Okay, that's all cool. No, it's both those things. Somehow, it's not in time and in time at the same time. Okay, that's the mystery.
Spirit X wrapped in the enigma.
Right. Okay. That's the Trinity mystery. He's trying to get you to the Trinity mystery. He's trying to get you both the bottom up and the top down point of view, so that you actually you have the mystery in front of you and can begin to work with the mystery. There's really no mystery in just the bottom up point of view of the Trinity. You know, as a matter of fact, as we're beginning to recognize, that's really crude and inadequate to understand the Paradise Trinity. You know, really what that gets you is the first triunity. It doesn't really get you the Paradise Trinity. All right, let's finish up this section. Anyway, so he's been building up to that. He was going to get it in there somehow. And he found a way to use the individuality viewpoint to suggest.
The Trinity is so related to total universe affairs that it must be reckoned with in our attempts to explain the totality of any isolated cosmic event or personality relationship. The Trinity functions on all levels of the cosmos, and mortal man is limited to the finite level. Therefore, must man be content with the finite concept of the Trinity as the Trinity.
So there it is. There's the statement in the book. The Trinity functions on all levels of the cosmos. You know, the functional levels of deity. Okay, it's on all of them. And, you know, as an initial understanding of that engagement of all seven functional levels, you can start with the Trinity of Absoluteness. Okay, but to, but to bring a little bit more clarity into the picture and not just have the Trinity as something that seems to be floating up, you know, at the absolute level and, you know, so who cares? That Trinity of absoluteness comes down when it can. Okay? And when you're in the fifth functional level, where deity engages finite creatures, creature-identified deity, the sevenfold, okay, therefore must man be content with a finite concept of the Trinity as the Trinity. The Trinity of supremacy, the functioning of Trinity, you know, the Trinity on the supreme level, you know, where it engages the finite.
We can probably experience.
And you know, and there's points in the book where they talk about this. It's like, say, for instance, the I'll get you just one second. For instance, the absolute facet of your or absolute dimension of your personality. Now, technically, you know, if you're really like reaching up in that dimension of your personality, are you actually going to consciously wrap your mind around absoluteness through that dimension? No. I mean, you could right now, you can technically, you can only reach in terms of comprehension up to the supreme level. That's the maximum. And so, you know, in, experientially, you know, sort of functionally as a finite being, that absolute dimension is a supreme dimension. See, this is the way it works. I mean, the Trinity of absoluteness comes down as a Trinity of supremacy. You know, your potential to engage absoluteness can go up to supremacy, you know, and there the two of you meet. You know, just like that's where, you know, the thought adjuster can come down to the supreme level and you can work your way up to the supreme level and there the two of you meet. You know, they're going to bring that up in the next section, this whole bit about the Trinity of supremacy, the Trinity of ultimacy, and the Trinity of absoluteness. But he's alluding to it here, foreshadowing it here, that you've got the Trinity of absoluteness, as it were, sort of on all levels, but it penetrates down when it can. And that's what's indicated, see, on the total deity chart. You know, this is the circuit. You know, this second one from the outside is the circuit of the functioning of the Trinity, also the circuit of the Mother. Okay? And notice how I've indicated things. You know, I've indicated where, knowing that the Trinity functions on all levels, you know it goes all the way around. Okay? And, you know, here it reaches down and immediately it's contacting the, you know, absolute facts. So you have the Trinity of absoluteness. Same way here, Trinity of absoluteness. Same way here, Trinity of absoluteness. Here, Trinity of absoluteness. Okay, but over here, it can penetrate down a little bit. And so what I've actually put in there is the Trinity of ultimacy. Here, Trinity of supremacy. Here, Trinity of supremacy. Okay. But that's what they're talking about here. You know, you have the Trinity functioning all the way around and penetrating down where there is depth to penetrate. And right here, the fifth functional level, where you have creature-identified deity, where deity is engaging us, okay, we must be satisfied with a finite concept of the Trinity as the Trinity. The functioning of Trinity is the Trinity of supremacy.
As we would experience that, would that be like when you see something that's beautiful, we know that it also has to be true and good.
That's a little bit first triunity thinking.
Okay.
You know, you're trying to, you know, use truth, beauty, and goodness. And it's like, well, yes and no. You know, just the Trinity is a separate functioning. And you know, when we get into the following sections, we'll see a little bit, you know, more about what that functioning looks like.
Trinity could be, in other words, a body in all the fourth dimension, technically all time, out of time, and at the same time, in other words, a shape in it.
But the Father and the Son and the Spirit are the same way. The Universal Father, the Eternal Son, and the Infinite Spirit are also, they exist outside of space and time. And so all four of them, all four of those facts engage us in the sense you're thinking of completely transcendent. They engage us as an omnipresence. It's like they're in another dimension. They're not down in the three finite dimensions. Or, when they engage all three of them in totality all at the same time, however you want to think about it. And the thing about higher dimensional physical theories, Kaluza-Klein theories that lead to string theory and stuff like that, the difference in the revelation is there is more than the three finite dimensions, but they're not like dimensions like they are in the, when you bring in the fifth dimensions and things like this and those theories. There are seven dimensions. Three are finite, three are absonite, and one is absolute. This transcendence of the three finite dimensions isn't because there's another like dimension that something is in. In the sense of, if you imagine our universe is flatland, okay, and you're just a circle or a square or a triangle living in flatland, and all of a sudden this mystical thing occurs in your universe, suddenly there's this point that just appears out of nowhere, and then the point grows into a circle and a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger circle, and it gets really big, and then it starts shrinking again and becomes a smaller and smaller circle until it becomes a point and disappears. And you go, whoa, there's just been a mystical thing that's occurred. What actually happened? A sphere passed through flatland. Okay? Okay? And people have contemplated, like that's why that book Flatland was written. People contemplating that notion of transcendence that might be what the transcendence of God is all about, is being like God as the sphere, relative to us being, planar figures. And it's like, yes, but not quite. Because the higher dimensionality that God's presence exists in isn't just another dimension that's like the three that we have, in the sense that the third dimension that the sphere is in is like the two of the flatland. For instance, when God comes down from the absolute and engages the finite, he does so through the absonite. And the way the absonite engages the finite is not as another dimension, but as a transcendent dimension, which means that any line in the absonite, like if you take a particular absonite axis, the absonite x-axis, that maps into all directions, all axes in the finite. Because it's not just another dimension, it's a transcendent dimension. And this, that fact,
it's almost like a super additive.
The guys that have been playing around with multidimensional theories, have known since the 20s, when Kaluza and Klein first put these ideas forward, that there seemed to be something there. It seemed to be kind of giving some sense of what we observe, but not quite. And they haven't been able to figure out why. It seems to be kind of a good idea, but not quite. See, it's because they're trying to make what's actually absonite, transcendent dimensions, with more finite dimensions. And that's the problem. Okay.
As a mortal in the flesh, you should view the Trinity in accordance with your individual enlightenment and in harmony with the reactions of your mind and soul. You can know very little of the absoluteness of the Trinity, but as you ascend paradiseward, you will many times experience astonishment at successive revelations and unexpected discoveries of Trinity supremacy and ultimacy, if not of absoluteness.
Notice that he's saying,
teaching and
you don't have to wait. Okay. He's saying, I know the Trinity is really hard to understand. And if you can't get very far, that's okay. But, you should attempt to view it in accordance with your individual enlightenment. Not your initial individual ignorance. Okay? But he is challenging you to have a progressively more enlightened picture. See? And that's what we're about in talking about total deity. We're trying to get the machinery in place so that we can think about the Trinity in more than just some simple anthropomorphic-like way. We're just kind of talking about the first triunity at best. And we're lucky at that. We may just be still talking about the old Trinity of Christendom. Okay? And we really aren't getting very far. We're putting a lot of new wine in old wineskins. Okay? So
this is the kind of understanding Jesus had, do you think, when he was walking on this earth?
Mm-hmm.
And it was growing as he was doing things in him.
Right. And what he did is what we can do. Everything that he did up to the baptism is what you can do.
These works and even greater works you shall also
see. Yeah. You can't do the part where, now you're creator, God and man. Okay, you can't do that part. But but you can get yourself all the way up to those higher levels of consciousness where you can begin to really utilize the perspective that the adjuster can facilitate, and this top-down point of view can be quite approachable. It doesn't have to be inscrutable. You don't have to talk to your adjuster to get this or anything. You're just challenging to have a more top-down point of view, and it's much easier for the adjuster to help you with that top-down point of view than it is for the adjuster to help you with a better bottom-up point of view. It just doesn't really work in that mode. But it'll help you, in grokking the top-down point of view long before you can talk to it. Okay? That's what this is about. All right.
By the way, I figured out the acronym for grok.
Oh.
Getting realization of knowledge.
Okay. Okay, so we'll have a lot of fun next time. Next time we get the stuff that we refer to so often as how the Trinity is the foundation for the Mother. That's coming up right in the first paragraph here next time. Let's take a moment here.